This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Steve Leto. He's written a book called Chrysler's Turbin Car, The Rise and Fall of Detroit's Coolest Creation. And interestingly, and that's part of the story, it has a foreword by Jay Leno. Hey, Steve, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well. So, you know, I am a car enthusiast, so I was pretty interested in reading this book right away as soon as I heard about it. I remember the Chrysler Turbin cars very well. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted one, just like
right.
millions of other people. But I'm assuming, since this, you know, the kind of heart of your story took place in the early 60s, 63, 64, 65, that many, many people who are alive today have no clue about what happened, what this was all about. So maybe you could kind of give the short summary of the whole, or at least the beginning of the Chrysler Turbin car story, and then we can talk some more about, you know, some of the really interesting details that you've uncovered.
Yeah, after World War II, the jet engines became very popular, were being developed for a lot of different purposes by a lot of different people. And the military was using them, but the car companies also looked at them. Chrysler dove in whole hog to developing Chrysler, developing turbine cars and turbine engines to be put in those cars. And they developed more than the other car companies did. And, you know, they had a whole department devoted to building, in essence, jet cars.
Oh, and let me just interrupt you and say, for people who didn't know at that time, let's say the late, you know, the post-war period, Chrysler's reputation as a car manufacturer was that they were really strong in engineering, but less strong, let's say, in sales, and early in the 50s, you know, clearly less strong in design. You know, but their reputation was clearly they were the engineering leader in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely, and they were known for once in a while, you know, really hitting one out of the park, you know, groundbreaking technology or styling. Occasionally, the airflow, for instance, was a Chrysler, but they had developed military application jet engines during World War II, and then when the war ended, they just said, hey, you know, something. Let's see if we can put these things into cars. And by 1953, Chrysler built a jet engine small enough and durable enough to just shoehorn it into a car. And they drove the thing around, and it worked really, really well. And they said, hey, let's keep working on this. And so by the 1960s, they had gotten the technology so well advanced that they could build a fleet of cars, which they did. They built 55 cars. And they, as part of a big publicity stunt, in essence, lent the cars out to the public. So for a couple of years, if you wanted a jet car for a few months, you could contact Chrysler, and if you were lucky enough to have your name in essence drawn, they would come to your house and give you a jet car, and you could use it for 3 months, and just as long as you put fuel in it, the Chrysler insured it and took care of it for you. And so there was a period of time, you said, you know, the mid-60s, where if you lived, especially in southeastern Michigan, but pretty much anywhere in North America, you might see a jet car drive by, and they were all the same color. They all sounded alike. They sounded like jets, and you couldn't miss it. And if you saw one, it made a lasting impression. And I remember seeing these things when I was a little kid, going, wow, a jet car. Just imagine, soon we'll all be driving them. And, of course, that's not what happened.
Well, no, and they were, I remember, you know, my memory of it is, I have this distinctive memory of reading the article in Popular Mechanics. And,
yeah.
You know, then, of course, I was a model car builder at that point, and there, as I recollect, there was maybe it was a Johann model car,
yeah.
Where you could, you know, build the kit. But they also produced hundreds and thousands of models of the car that they gave away. They were all bronze, beautiful bronze
yeah.
color. They also were all built in Italy by GIA and then shipped back to the United States for the installation of the drivetrain. And,
yeah.
you know, you talked about one of the things that I actually didn't know, which I thought was really interesting, was that it took 1 week to build each car, so that the 55 cars you're talking about, it took them over a year to build them all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing is we forget that, you know, nowadays we're so used to the idea of mass production. Chrysler used the GIA studios in Italy to build all their show cars, but GIA was also equipped to build slightly larger runs of cars, and so they built these cars, and they built, in essence, 55 of the turbine cars, the GIA turbine cars, and then the spare parts for a few more. And I've spoken to guys who worked on these cars back then, and they joked about it because the trunk from one car would not fit on another car. And, you know, one or two of the cars were actually involved in very minor accidents, and one of them got rear-ended at a light in Chicago. And they took it to a local body shop there, and the guy said, you know, I could straighten this trunk up, but can you send me a new one? And they sent it to him, and it didn't fit. It was off by 3 inches. And they said, guess what? You're going to have to hammer that one back out again, which he did. But, yeah, they were actually all hand-built, and in essence, they were each custom-built, too. It's kind of an interesting little angle there.
Right, but all the cars, you know, drove the same. They made sure that all of the mechanics were the same, although it was clear that they did make running engineering changes as they went. They used the 55 cars, and in particular the 50 that were loaned out to American drivers as test beds so they could figure out what things would happen under mass use or the unintended things, you know, things you couldn't predict that people would do that would not work.
Right.
Or would cause problems. And, of course, with any, you know, this was a new technology. It had all kinds of, I mean, they tried to make the car work as much like a regular car as possible because, of course, you have, even by 1963, you know, 60 years more or less of embedded learning about how a car should work. So that,
right.
You know, if you're planning on mass producing a new power plant in a car, you can't have it be too funny, you know, that it would need to be fairly normal. I was thinking a little bit of that. You mentioned steam cars in one part of the book, you know, that the most developed steam cars were probably in the early 30s, the Dobles, that were, you know, fantastic feats of engineering, but they still were just slightly quirky. You know, they were not quite what people were used to in driving a gasoline-powered car. Now, of course, this gets to another question. I mean, there's so many things I thought that were really interesting in this book. One was that they had a crew of people who would travel anywhere in America on the drop of a hat to either fix a car that wasn't working or to solve a problem that arose. You know, that's a pretty amazing idea. I mean, obviously, you know, we had airplanes in the early 60s, but really you don't think of a company going that far to, you know, kind of instantly take care of their product.
Yeah, they were very concerned. They put the 55 cars out there, and they wanted the cars to both, it was a big experiment to see how they'd work, but also as a big, you know, a huge advertisement for Chrysler. And they were very concerned about the public image angle of it. And it turns out that the cars were relatively trouble-free, but on the rare occasion one failed, Bill Carey, who's one of the guys I interviewed for the book, was the head technician on the program, and he got to, you know, answer those late-night phone calls. And he would literally get called at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, yeah, a car just broke down in Dallas. Get there and fix it. And he would hop on a plane, fly down there, and usually he said if he suspected it was an engine problem, rather than trying to repair it in the field, he'd actually just have to ship an engine down there he'd need it at the airport, and then he would just swap it out and you know, and then ship the old one back to Detroit for, like, in essence, an autopsy. This is back, of course, you know, before you could, you know, book airline tickets on the Internet, and he was telling me about how, you know, he had a list of all the scheduled flights out of Detroit Metro Airport so he could figure out how quickly he could get to someplace where one of these cars broke down unexpectedly. And, you know, just running around taking care of those kinds of little fires was what Bill Carey did for 3 years, you know. And it's he's the guy in the cover of the book. That's one of the reasons he belongs there, is, you know, the role he played in the story.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of great stories in the book. I thought, you know, the engineers, particularly, I guess, the guy Huebner is really the kind of the key figure, really brilliant engineer. And then there's the metallurgist, Roy, who I thought, you know, was also highly, you know, they were really responsible for a lot of the advances that allowed this to work. And, of course, the turbine, you know, it has advantages over the piston engine because there are fewer moving parts. It's metal, you know, circular movement rather than up and down in circular movement. So there are some engineering principles that make the turbine, the jet engine, kind of have some advantages over the piston engine, but because they turn at really high speeds, they had a lot of stress. They had to invent new metals that would work at the high temperatures that they were operating on for really long periods of time. And then, of course, I thought the real key issue that you identified as a kind of really almost insurmountable problem for them was that so many of the key parts had to be built or manufactured using lost wax. And the lost wax method is very time-consuming. It's almost like engineering a part or manufacturing a part one at a time.
Different than
kind of punching or casting a large, you know, motor in a foundry where you can have an assembly line.
And that was really one of the last decisions that they looked at, which finally killed the program, because they got to the point where they thought, you know, we've got the engines, they're bulletproof, we could build these, we could put them on the road if we wanted to, but to bring the cost down to something that would be manageable and saleable to the American public, they would really have had to mass produce them on the same scale they could mass produce, like the Solant 6, you know. And so to do that, they'd have to build a whole new plant from the ground up because they couldn't retool an existing plant because the tools were so different. And on the earlier turbine cars, ones that they did put on the road, they were having all these parts custom made at local facilities here in southeastern Michigan. And they said, you know, to build this plant from the ground up would be so cost prohibitive. And that was right around the time Chrysler hit their first financial problem, right before we had Coca saved them. And so, if you know, those two things coinciding right there, it wasn't going to happen.
Now, that was the time you're talking about is the late 60s.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Early
70s. A couple other problems that played into the demise of the program. No one saw the tailpipe emission standards coming from the EPA. The problem with smog was first identified in the 60s, and in the late 60s and early 70s, the federal government decided to stomp on, you know, tailpipe emissions. And Chrysler spent 15, 20 years developing turbine technology and making these things efficient. But efficiency for them was simply, let's get as much horsepower out of a little engine that we can. And when the government comes along and says, oh, by the way, next year, guys, every vehicle on the road's got a tailpipe emissions that are, you know, of this standard, and they're picking numbers out of thin air, they couldn't rejigger the engine that quickly to solve that problem. And likewise, the CAFE standards, the mileage, they started clamping down right after the OPEC oil embargo. And again, that played into it as well.
You know, it's sort of ironic, as you see here, is that, you know, the turbine probably, if it had had enough development resources put on it, the way, I mean, of course, you know, look at the piston engine represents, even by, let's say, 1975, that's almost 100 years of engineering development across literally thousands of companies. And
yeah,
even by then, where there were still, you know, maybe only four big manufacturers in the U.S., and there were, you know, one in each of the major industrial countries of the world, you know, the combined engineering and dollars that have been spent on a piston engine is probably really high. And it's very difficult for a new technology with limited dollars to put against it to have the same development that the piston engine did. And so what happened, I think, is, you know, Chrysler, not having the deepest pockets, in the world, couldn't, and not being able to spread the cost of development over enough units manufactured and sold, they just had to give up. They couldn't put enough resources to bear on the turbine engine.
Right.
But, you know, of course, if GM, Ford, and Chrysler had combined their resources behind the turbine and shared technology, even though they were competitors, you could have, I think the turbine actually, in the long run, they could have solved the problems of NOx just the way, you know, we've solved the problems of hydrocarbon emissions in piston cars. And they probably would have then had an engine that did not require petroleum, which, to me, that's the key. At that time, gas cost 25 cents a gallon. So there was really no incentive economically to develop an engine that could run on, you know, almost anything. And what I love about the turbine is you could pour, you know, I think you talked about this, you know, you could pour perfume into it and it would run.
Yeah, they would do demonstrations. They'd run the turbine car on vegetable oil or peanut oil or Chanel number 5, which, of course, would be more expensive than gasoline, I assume. But and anything that burns, they would run the car on. But the funny thing is that in 1964, that was a novelty. That was like a trick because nobody cared. They'd go, so what? You know, who cares that you can run it on home heating oil? Gasoline going 19 or 25 cents a gallon or whatever it is. Why would we care? Gasoline is so cheap and plentiful. And, you know, little did we realize that gasoline would, you know, soon break $1 and $2 and $3 a gallon. And so the it turns out that the prime, you know, the biggest feature of the engine, its multi-fuel capabilities, was almost completely ignored at the time. And I've gone through tons of Chrysler literature, and oftentimes the multi-fuel capability is not even mentioned, or if it's mentioned, it's mentioned in passing. And it's more kind of like, hey, we ran this thing on peanut oil. You know, the tailpipe smells like you're baking cookies. And it was like a big joke.
Right. Well, now, so today, you know, and of course, this is a very sad story for anybody who loves cars. Most of the cars were destroyed after they took them out of use.
Yeah.
You know, probably, for good reason. Now I sort of realize, you know, back then when I was a kid, you know, it was almost heartbreaking to imagine them destroying these cars, but
right.
You know, they had to, they couldn't allow them to sneak into circulation. You know, if somebody bought one and started to drive it, it would not be good for Chrysler's image to have
right.
them broken down on the side of the road because you know, there were no parts for it.
Right.
So there are now 9 left. They saved a few, mostly put them into historical collections and museums. But there are a couple that reached private hands, and of course one of them has now reached the hands of Jay Leno, which is pretty interesting.
And it's kind of interesting because I had written the manuscript of this book quite a while ago, and I had a hard time getting a publisher. And a few years back, Jay Leno, somebody sent him an advertisement out of a newspaper that it was kind of goofy, but I had written a book called Death's Door, and it has a very, very depressing cover of its black and white cover, and it's got an image on it that's of a gravestone. And somebody up north in Michigan had run an ad that said, Death's Door makes a great Christmas gift. And somebody sent that ad to Jay Leno, and he ran it on his Funny Headlines segment.
Right.
And I thought it was funny, too, you know, in that context. And so I took a copy of Death's Door and I gift wrapped it and mailed it to him. But I sent him a copy of the manuscript to the turbine car story. And this is before he owned one. And he called me and he said, Steve, I've always loved these cars. I've always loved this story. If there's any way I can ever help you, let me know. And about a year or two later, when he bought a turbine car, he called me back and said, I need to get a hold of one of the guys you interviewed in the book because I might need help with my turbine car. So I got the two of them together, and then Jay called me back to thank me and said, Steve, if you're ever in California, I'll let you drive my turbine car.
Well, that's an offer I could hardly refuse.
Yeah, so I got out to California as quickly as I could. He let me drive his car, which was very, very neat. And then afterwards he said, if it'll help you, I'll write a foreword for your book. And that was what actually pushed it over the top, and I managed to get an agent who then sold the book, and without Jay it wouldn't have happened.
That's great, and he is a tremendous, you know, obviously an American icon, but for anybody interested in cars, everyone knows about his car collection, that he's like a big kid. You know, he loves cars as much as any car enthusiast in America. His impulse, he's not collecting because he thinks that, you know, it's not like an artificial thing. He's not collecting art. He's collecting cars because he loves them. And he likes to drive them. And so, I think it's actually great. If the turbine car is going to be in private hands, it's wonderful that it's in somebody's hands who can actually drive it and maintain it, which is, you know, that's clearly, you know, there's a kind of finite future for the car, any car that's left that runs on that turbine, because there's going to be no, you know, no spare parts and no ability to support them at some point.
Right, and he gave me a tour of his whole collection. He's got 105 cars. He's got almost 100 motorcycles. He's got a staff of guys who do nothing but maintain them for him. Every car in his collection is plated and insured and fueled up and ready to go, and he drives them. And that's the thing, is he drives a turbine car around town. And he called me one day, we were talking about this, And I said, Jay, I go, you know, have you got a chance to drive it yet? And he goes, you got to be kidding me. He goes, I've been driving it every day since I got it, you know. And I'm sure by now it's worked, you know, it's worked into the rotation. But he does drive these cars. It's not like the trailer queens are sitting in a bubble somewhere. They're actually being driven and maintained as cars.
Well, it must be amazing. You know, I know people in California are kind of, especially in Hollywood and, you know, L.A., where, you know, there are a lot of very exotic cars on the road every day. You kind of, you know, if you just set yourself down on Sunset Strip, you can see almost every car that you'd ever want to see that you won't see anywhere else. But, you know, seeing the Turbine car, the Chrysler Turbine car on the road, has got to be one of the great experiences. Now, the design of those cars, I want to talk about that a little bit. The, you know, I remember the pictures of them when I was a kid, and, you know, you see the, it has clearly a kind of aircraft style look. They did that on purpose to, you know, associate it with the Turbine, but a little bit interesting design connection to the Ford Thunderbird, because of the fact that Chrysler had brought in a former Ford designer.
Elwood Engel was brought over from Ford to Chrysler and definitely got there. They said, by the way, one of your first projects is design something to put the Turbine car in, a Turbine engine in, and we want it to be a special car. And so people have noticed that it has a bit of a similarity to the early Seabird, but that's what Elwood Engel had made his name designing. And so he designed this car. It's got space age styling touches throughout. And I like to point out that the most obscure one is that the little bar that holds the rear view mirror to the windshield has got aluminum cooling fins on it, which of course are not functional in any way, shape, or form, except that they look cool.
Right. Well, and yeah, right. In the early 60s, that was, you know, the aircraft element in cars design was very important for a lot of,
yes,
a lot, and so they had a lot of non-functional design cues. But you did mention also, I thought, you know, very tiny bit of trivia, but those rearview mirrors were in fact glued to the windshield, and that was a first.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it came along at a time where they actually did incorporate, you know, not everything they did was just for show, and there were some very ingenious things they did on this car. And some make sense, and some are just, you know, practicality. You know, for instance, you could not pop the hood on this car without getting inside of it. In 1963, that was unusual. Any mid-60s car, you can walk up from the outside and pop the hood. And Chrysler was concerned that if I drove my Turbine car to the store and then went inside to go shopping, some teenage hoodlums might come up and pop the hood to see what the engine looks like. And they didn't want that happening without the user being there. And so they went with a remote hood release, which, of course, now every car's got on the road. And the same is true for the trunk. The trunk did not have a key or anything you could use to access it from the outside. There was a lever in by the back seat, and again, you had to get inside the car and pop the lever that way, because they didn't want people monkeying around with these cars.
Well, so do you think there's any chance that the Turbine would be redeployed for automotive transport? Do you think that technology, you know, could be rescued in some way, or is it just impossible at this point?
I think that there's a distinct possibility that it might come back in a hybrid form. I know that Williams International, which was founded by Sam Williams, who worked on the Chrysler Turbine car, a few years back built a small turbine unit that would go in the trunk of an EV1. So that when the electrical car ran out of charge, if it wasn't near a charging station, could fire up an engine and run off gasoline or something and recharge the battery. And that would be the perfect application, would be to have an engine like that recharging the batteries on an electric car.
Right, of course, it would run on almost any fuel.
Yes, yes. Now, whether or not they'd ever make a turbine car be the primary mover of the car, I don't know if that'll happen, the turbine engine. Because they still had not resolved some of the issues. There's an acceleration lag when you step on the gas. At idle, they burn a lot of fuel. And there's a few other issues which would probably cost too much to resolve. But in a hybrid setting, I think that they really could do it.
Now, is the turbine, you know, relative to its output, lighter than the piston engine? Is that one of the advantages?
Yes, it's lighter. It's, you know, we're talking about, you know, percentages of, you know, 30 or 40% lighter than a piston engine of comparable power output. It also has fewer moving parts. The parts spin rather than reciprocate, so they last longer. The turbine car that was in the Chrysler Ghia program had a single spark plug, which only needed replacement every 25 or 50,000 miles. It doesn't use oil in the traditional sense, so there's no oil changes ever. The only maintenance it ever really needed was it needed at the air cleaners popped out once in a while and cleaned, and that was it. So the maintenance costs were lower, it was simpler, it was smoother, you know. I mean, it really had a lot of advantages.
Yeah, it sure did. Well, you know, I think it's actually an amazing story, and you have tremendous, you know, kind of a lot of personal interest stories. There are a lot of narrative, narratives by people who use the cars and people who worked on them, and I think it's a really fun book. You don't have to be a car nut like I am to enjoy the book. It's also a kind of a piece of Americana, a history of a period which, you know, is not that long ago, but seems like a long time ago. And, I think it's a terrific book, and I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Thank you. I like talking about it.
Well, yeah, obviously you do, but it's a good story, and I think it's really fun to talk about. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Steve Leto about his new book called Chrysler's Turbine Car, The Rise and Fall of Detroit's Coolest Creation. I think it's a great subtitle and very apt. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you, David.